Putin. And that's one of the reasons why they haven't been able to outwardly support Ukraine, although there have been pictures of Israeli armored personnel vehicles that have appeared in the Ukraine. And so the Israeli weapons exporters have gotten sort of tacit permission from the government to sort of under the table start sending weapons to Ukraine. But it's something that they very definitely want to not create any embarrassment or complication in the relationship with Russia for the reasons I just mentioned.
Well, I'm going to have to leave it right there. I really want to thank you, Richard Silverstein. People can check your work out at Tikkun Olam. You also write for a whole bunch of places, Middle East Eye, New Arab, Jacobin Magazine. And we always thank you for the good information. Please stay safe. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Dennis. Great to be with you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care now. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. And guess what? That's it.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Tune in the fourth Monday of each month at 11:30 a.m. to Voices for the Animals.
We discuss the latest news and trends in the animal world
and the role of activism surrounding the issues of animal rights.
That's Voices for the Animals at 11:30 a.m. on the fourth Monday of each month on KBOO.
Hi, this is Frank with a PH and a hard C. Your basic average all-American Jewish lesbian folk singer coming out to you on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly youth-centered podcast where we talk to artists to find out what they do and how they do it. And I'm Nicole Cabrera, and we're joined by the high school students of McDaniels.
And I'm Erica Thomas. For the remainder of this school year, we'll be live at McDaniel High School. This month, our guest is Nan Curtis. Welcome to the show, Nan.
Thank you.
I'll keep passing the mic and the camera around, and we'll let everybody introduce themselves.
My name is Sam. I'm a sophomore here at McDaniel, and I'm in the mixed media area linked to studies.
Who's your teacher?
Sarah Beth.
Sarah Beth. Is teaching mixed media art, or is it multifaceted?
They're teaching English, but it's like multi teachers working together.
I'm Louie. I'm also a sophomore, and I'm in the same like mixed media like linked design thing. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
I'm Lainey. I'm also a sophomore. I'm also in mixed media. I think all three of us are in the same class. So.
Yeah.
Great. Welcome, Lainey.
I'm Sebastian. I am in two different journalism classes, and I'm a junior. I am an editor on the newspaper this year, so that's who I am.
Welcome back, Sebastian. Okay, great. Nan, can you tell the students a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yes, I can. My name's Nan Curtis. I'm originally from Kentucky, and I went to graduate school in Ohio, and a bunch of us from graduate school decided to move to Portland, Oregon on a whim in 1992, and I've been here since. I was hired at Pacific Northwest College of Art shortly after I got here and started my teaching career, as well as exhibiting in the local galleries and Pacific Northwest in general along the West Coast with a couple of nationwide shows, even international shows, over the past 30 years, essentially. Oh my gosh, 30 years, that's right. And I have been a practicing artist that whole time. I retired from teaching just before the pandemic, wild timing, March of 2020. I gave notice. And I am really committed to my studio practice, which is, this is my studio back here, and in a new way, and spending a lot of time here. And then I'm also retraining to be an end-of-life doula, a death doula, to help people die. And there is, I'm trying to discover kind of the collision between my own art practice and my passion for helping people die, because it's more of a calling than a career. You kind of can do it or you can't. And apparently I'm someone that can. I've helped about 9 people die now, and it's pretty awesome and intense. And so that's kind of where my life is right now. I just got done with a really big art show for me that unfortunately closed like 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, right at the end of October. And hopefully, oh, I sent you guys my Instagram so that you could look at that for images. I did a lot of Instagram posting.
Thanks, Nan.
That's it.
A backwards intro.
Excellent.
Well, we heard a little bit about where you grew up in Kentucky and how you kind of managed to move out to Portland on a whim, you said?
Yeah, kind of. We just wanted out of Ohio.
As a fellow Ohioan, I can't blame you.
I actually think it's a pretty cool place now. People should move there.
It's a different scene, completely different place now. Yeah. It's really cheap to live there, but also a lot of stuff has changed that makes it better to live. Anyway, so sometimes we do like to ask artists to share a little bit about what it was like for them growing up. So yeah, I lived in Ohio, and I've also lived in Kentucky. And even though I did have a really wonderful time when I was living in Kentucky, and I was becoming an artist when I was living there, I'm curious what it was like for you as a young person growing up in Louisville, and whether you thought when you were young, yeah, I want to be an artist, or whether that was something that happened later, and what kind of maybe role models or understandings of art did you sort of like come across in your youth?
Mm-hmm. So I'm the youngest of 4 kids, and there's a lot of years between us. So by the time I came around, my parents were like, whatever you want to do is fine. They've been pre-vetted, and, you know, and I was just always good at art. In school, people encouraged me. You know, everybody got the same assignment. Mine won the award. I liked doing it. I actually spent time on it. And then I went to a really special high school called St. Francis High School. It was a private inner city high school. And we had an exceptional art teacher. And I will say that even up to that point, I had very good art teachers. Most of my art teachers were artists. And so they were coming to teaching through practice, which was fascinating. And so that was true. I lived in Chicago for a short amount of time, and that was true there. And then in my middle school, I also had a really good art teacher, Mr. Mucci. He was awesome. But then in high school, we had this exceptional experience, and the art teacher was amazing, and it was a small school. We had nude models in high school. I mean, they did some really outrageous stuff. We were exposed to Louisville, Kentucky has an excellent art museum called The Speed that was kind of like our classroom. we studied all kinds of artists and art and years, and it was definitely game-changing. I ended up going to a really small liberal arts college in Ohio because my parents did not want me to go to art school. They supported me being an artist and encouraged me, but they didn't want me to I wanted to go to Pratt in Brooklyn. In Brooklyn at that point, I mean, I don't know, it was a big city and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. That seemed scary to them. And so they wouldn't let me do that, but I found a college in Ohio called Worcester that had an independent study program for their senior year where you did 1 year focused on whatever your thing was. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty interesting because I could develop an entire body of work in a year. And so I ended up going to Worcester, which was exactly true. I developed a really sophisticated body of work. I loved my teacher. We had a sculpture teacher, a photo teacher, and then printmaking and drawing. They wouldn't even let us have nude models in my college. After coming out of high school, they made them wear jock straps and bras. It was so weird. But, I'm not sure if it's lucky or not, but I kind of always knew what I was gonna do. I went right out of high school in a good program into a college where I got my degree in studio arts. I graduated with an excellent body of work and went directly into grad school. By the time I moved to Portland with my MFA, I was 25. So I was young and the path was kind of written for me and no one stood in the way. My parents, when I mean encourage me, it means they didn't stand in my way. It's not like they were like, she's so great, good job, Nan. They were just like, I think she's okay over there, you know, last one. But it just happened. Nobody ever stopped me from doing it. And let's be honest, making things is so fun. It actually, once you do it for as long as I have, you realize that it's kind of the way that you process your world. And so that is how you make sense of things. And that's, you know, right now, that's a pretty profound way to think, by making things. So that's how I ended up making art.
Cool. I don't want to keep you guys waiting. Do you all have questions yet? Okay, that's fine. That's okay. I have lots of questions.
One thing I will say that just looking at all of you all, you know, I taught at Pacific Northwest College of Art for 27 years. You look like every one of my students. Like, you know, you're coming in, you have this diverse group of people. I love them. My favorite group of people to teach is freshmen. Those incoming ones, they're just like psyched. They can't believe they're at art school. It's totally incredible. And the energy, it's hands down the best thing. So looking at this image of who's in this room, it makes me so excited. There's the future. It's good stuff.
I really like what you have to say about using your work to process the world, and I agree that it is a really powerful thing, and especially also agree right now. And some of the questions that I have for you relate to, I'm actually really curious about your use of materials. I'm not a sculptor, but I've always had like a little crush on sculpture as a discipline, and I think it's interesting. The way I understand kind of the way that sculptors work, the sculpture is occupying space. So you're thinking a lot about space. And then you're also thinking about how to take materials and sort of like morph them into something new. And I know that there's a lot more things going on with sculpture, but just to break down like a few of the like elemental things that make sculpture sculpture for the students. So I'm curious, how your use of materials is something that you use to process your ideas, or if you have any kind of relationship with like this metamorphosis of ideas or materials.
Materials are, for me, and it's not true for all artists. A lot of artists come to their making like, you know, if they're using the same material all the time, take for instance, a painter. And yes, they're passionate about their materials, but they know what their materials are. They're using it based on their confidence of doing it. And I'm not going to say that's true for every painter, but they're not reinventing the wheel each time they go there. What they are reinventing is the image and the message that they're imparting on the viewer. For me, I'm always looking for new materials, and I like raw material. And in my studio back here, for those who can see it, I have a whole shelf of raw material. What that means for me is different from someone else. Like, I literally like raw cotton, rubber, sheets of rubber, plaster gauze. I like to body cast a lot. I like found objects. I like things like old diaries, because you know they're loaded with information, and even without reading it, you know that it's a personal object, and so you can kind of begin to relate to it as an object, even though you have no idea what's written on the inside of it. You had mentioned that thing about architecture, and I think a lot about that. So first off, the people that I moved to Oregon with were all architects. And sculptors definitely think about space, because it is, when you put a sculpture on the ground, it's on the same plane as you, as a person. And so you immediately begin to have a relationship to it that's different than, say, if it were on a pedestal or on a wall. It's just different. It's not better or worse, it's just different. And I really like to exploit that, to work with that aspect where you and whatever that object are on the same plane, and then you can begin to kind of communicate or work together in some ways. Very often my work will be participatory or activated by the viewer, so that there really is this kind of play that happens between viewer and the object that gets made. But so I'm always, materials are actually typically my starting point. And that's not true with a lot of people. Usually you have an idea and then you go to build it, or you have, you just have an essence or a sense of something you want to do. I will start with bed springs that I found at a dump. And then I will begin to work the material, and all of a sudden I have this amazing object, which is this orb of bed springs that rolls around on the ground and is kind of a goofy, weird little object. So I often use that material as my starting point. Sometimes I'll start with an idea. I'm working on my new idea is that I want to build a pile. And it doesn't have to, I mean, that's nondescript, right? That pile could be out of just about anything, from dirt to blankets to old letters to a chair to, I have no idea. But I'm going to start, I want it to be big. So I'm going to have to use some stuff to make it big. And so I'm going to start looking for materials that would help me make a pile. I like the pile as a metaphor for family, because unlike that tree, the tree of life, the family tree that people talk about, my experience with family is not quite so aspirational. It's a little bit more of like stuff on top of stuff on top of stuff. And it's great. I mean, it makes for good connections with people in your family, but it's also heavy, just like you can imagine that a pile might be. So I like to use the pile as a metaphor for family, and I do a lot of that kind of work. How's that?
Great. Sebastian has a question.
You mentioned like seeing that family as like a pile. Have you ever tried to make a sculpture for that metaphor?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's my next project. I have done things. Sometimes I think about the family tree like a cloud. You know, a tree is so grounded. It's such an awesome object. It is both aspirational and well-grounded, and it makes me laugh that that's a metaphor for family, because that's just not typical of most families. They're not very well-grounded, and they're not particularly aspirational. And so I thought a cloud might be something that was a little more amorphous, and I started building clouds that were upholstered to the wall, and somehow that cloud looked like a pile to me, and all of a sudden that felt very aha. So I do want to physically build a huge pile in the middle of my studio, and quite frankly, I might just literally start grabbing everything from my studio and throwing it in there and then putting stuff on top, because I also feel like the weight or that burden that a pile feels, you know, nobody likes to be on the bottom of the pile, when there's a pig pile or something, you know, that's a worse place to be. So I feel like that actually is a pretty great metaphor. Ultimately, too, piles are grounded because they do end up being very close to the ground. So maybe that, I just think that's a better metaphor. So yeah, I'm building a pile. That's my next big project. You guys don't tell anybody though, okay? I'm gonna see what happens. I'm a little nervous about it.
You mentioned earlier about like body casting. Do you ever like, well, first, with your art, do you ever like sell your art or do you keep all your art?
Oh no, I would love to sell it. People just don't buy it enough. I sold a little bit at this last show. It's probably one of my most lucrative shows, the one I made most on it. But I also, it's rare that I make a piece that's not for sale. I don't get overly connected to it. Check this out. I did a piece with all of my diaries and I put them inside of a clamp and I welded it shut so that nobody could actually read my diaries, and it sold to a museum. So now my diaries are in a vice grip, welded shut, but nobody can read them. But I always get really nervous about the fact that somebody might be able to get in there. I'm really good at body casting. It's one of the beginnings of my artwork. And maybe this is a good story to tell you all. When I was in graduate school, I think I mentioned to you, I was pretty young. And I had come out of undergraduate with a really good body of work. It was all plaster casts of real bodies, large scale, you know, figurative work. And halfway through graduate school, I didn't pass my first year of graduate school because they told me that I wasn't taking any risks and that I was doing the same thing over and over again, which was body casting. And I kept putting the figure in a different position and reworking it and doing things like that. And I made a lot of work, but they were right. I wasn't taking any risks. I was doing what I knew best. And it's not that you can't be that kind of artist. It's just not for grad school. If you're in grad school, they want you to take risks and do, you know, and try new things. So, but you surely could be a plaster cast artist and make those and actually probably make quite a good living off of doing that. But they told me that I should remove the figure from my artwork. And that was like the most destructive thing they could have told me. I mean, it was all I knew how to do. And so all of a sudden, I was left in the lurch. I didn't know what to do. And I started collecting materials. And that would be about the time where I shifted over into kind of hoarding materials. I was collecting driftwood off of the beach and old, we used to be able to go into the dump and take things out. They have actually a residency for it now, but when I was younger, all the artists would get their materials there and I would get stuff from there. And I produced a pretty interesting show in graduate school, but funny thing about graduate school, and which is often true for a lot of people, not just me, it's not when you make your best work. It's when you do your most growth. Some of your best work happens right after graduate school, when you're all of a sudden on your own and you literally just have to make because you want to, not because somebody's making you do it. But it was at that point that I realized that the figure in my work was the audience, not the object that I made. And so, but you know what I really like to do is body cast pregnant women. So I body cast them when they're pregnant, and then they have this like object of themselves when they were pregnant. So I keep doing that, and I really like plaster gauze as a material. It's really fun and easy, but I don't do a lot of body casting as much anymore.
And then another question I had, my freshman year of high school, I actually didn't go here. I went to another high school in Oregon, Clackamas High School actually. And they have a really good ceramics class and a really good ceramics teacher and art teacher. Me and the art teacher didn't necessarily get along that well, but she was a really, really good teacher and art teacher. But me and my I took ceramics all year. Me and my ceramics teacher became very close, and she was a really good teacher and really made me think about, like, that's what I maybe want to do when I'm older. And mm-hmm. so hearing that, like, you've always wanted to be an artist ever since you were little, at least that's what I'm hearing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I'm hearing.
No, I think that's right.
It shows that, like, not everybody also wants to be an artist when they're a kid, because they're thinking, like, not all artists wanted to be an artist as a kid.
Right.
And some artists wanted to be an artist once they graduated high school, and then they realized, like, my art class, I really liked it. Like, that was, like, my most successful class. I guess my question is, like, what motivated you at the end to end up going to art school, or, like, going to an artist college?
It's, you know, honestly, that's the part that I mentioned where I'm not sure if it's a blessing or a curse, because honestly, I just don't think I thought about it, because I was good at something, and so I just kept doing it. I think now that I look back, maybe I wanted to be a nurse, and I never did that because I was good at art. You know, and so I just kept doing art. And I think art is a privilege. It's so special. It's different than, you know, any 9-to-5 kind of job. It's like, it's a passion. And if you can make it into a living in some way, what an incredible gift. So it's hard to complain about the fact that that I was able to do this thing and keep art in my life. But I'm just not sure I ever had to make a decision. And maybe that is kind of a bummer. Maybe it's when you have to or forced to make a decision, and then you go, gosh, you know, I was doing science all the way through high school, but I took that one art class and photo and I was good. All of a sudden you're like, well, shoot, maybe I should do that. We're not a culture or a country, the United States in particular, whereas in Europe, they encourage artists much more. They give them monthly stipends to live. They do all kinds of things. They pay for their apartments and schooling in other countries. We don't do that so much here. And so you never feel like you can. And my parents, but you can and you should. I mean, and then let's be honest. I'd actually have never made a living as an artist. I became a teacher. And the fact, art, being an artist doesn't make you a good teacher. It's just that I happen to actually be a good teacher too, just like your high school person, you know? And hopefully she's making ceramics too, because they are not, I always thought that being a teacher would keep me abreast or into the art world. It makes me aware of what's going on, but it didn't make me make more work. As a matter of fact, it kept me from making my work. But you do have to make a living. And I would say, I guess I want to say to you that if you want to be an artist and make a living doing it, then you have to treat it like a job. And for a lot of artists, that's a really hard thing to hear. They don't want to treat their art like a job, but that's how you make a living doing it. You apply for grants every single day. You get up and you work on your portfolio and update your website and you make connections and you go see art shows because that's part of your practice. And you stay committed to it. I have a student that graduated in from the MFA program about 3 years ago. And she is so far along. She has 3 residencies and she got a commission. She's applying for something at the airport. Like, she works so hard at being an artist. It blows my mind. And I would say that only about half of that is making the work. The rest of it is looking for grants, writing applications, making sure you have good images, making connections, talking to curators, you know? So, but I sure did love teaching. I loved being a teacher. So until I didn't, and then I didn't want to be a teacher anymore. But high school art teachers are some of the most important ones around. My son goes to Wells High School, and they have a very good art program there. Those art teachers are incredible. I'm very impressed by Portland Public School high school art teachers. They're an incredible breed. Y'all are lucky.
I guess one more question I have is, have you ever, like, gone to, like, for example, like, Target and, like, seen something and it, like, inspired you, like, oh, I really like that. I wonder if I can make an art piece like that. Or, like, got inspiration from what you saw at Target or what you saw on the streets or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. Steal everything you can. Absolutely. Because the truth is that if I saw that thing and then I went home and made it, it just wouldn't be that object. It would be my version of that object. And so it will always, yeah. I also think we're influenced all the time in ways that we don't know. It's happening to us and we don't know. And then we pop it out in artwork and we're like, I don't know where it came from, but it's in there, you know? And it doesn't have to be overt, but I would definitely go to Target and take things from them. Sometimes color is a big one.
Yeah.
I have a friend who only used the color palette of Target for her art project that she did. And I swear, just by looking at it, I can't even remember what she made. They were objects. But because of the color, you were like, it kind of reminds me of Target a little bit. And you're like, yeah, that's where it came from.
Yeah. Sebastian, did you have another question? Yes. Can you all pass the mic down?
So you mentioned that you've been a teacher before, and you're also an artist, clearly. And so I just had a question. What's something, like, art-specific that you think young people should really be taught?
Art? I think that, you know, honestly, I mean, it should be a requirement, you know? Because I remember teaching, I go into the classroom a lot for my kids. I have two boys that are 15 and 21, and all through their years, I was going into the classroom and doing lessons and projects with them. And like we would do like a self-portrait, and you'd always get the kid that's like, I can't do it. It's terrible. It's like, no, it's not. It's art. You actually can't be wrong. I mean, that's the beauty of it. And there's maybe nothing else that you do where you can't be wrong, you know? And so I think that's a really good lesson for kids, you know, all the way through. And if we keep chipping away at art and access to art, then they don't get that lesson. Then they only are, you know, going in and right now, you know, 8 classes every 2 days, 1 hour and 37 minutes in the classroom. That's tough. If it's all geometry, algebra, you know what I mean? If it's all that, where's the break? Where's the freedom to mess up a little bit? So I just think that you can't require it because there are enough people that don't want to do it at all. But that's because they don't really understand it either. It's like if they knew that they could go in there and do anything they wanted for 1 hour and 37 minutes, they might have a different way of thinking about it. But iPhone photography is pretty cool. They're getting really sophisticated with that. They're teaching that at my son's high school right now. And that blows my mind. It's really good stuff. And that's so accessible. So, the other thing that's really critical that I had already said to you, and this is more true as you go in further into school, but you really need to be learning about art as a business. You can't just go through school and like just do sculpture if your intention is to make it maybe a living at it or more than a hobby. Then you have to learn how to write resumes and apply for grants and do all that stuff. Do you remember that thing that people used to say is, I'm an artist, I don't have to write? It's like, oh, no, no, no. Artists have to write too. The beauty of it, though, is that you can pay someone else to do it. I just did that for my essay that I got for the show that I just had because I'm an okay writer, but I find that I have the least perspective on my work than anybody because I'm so in it that it's actually hard for me to step back out and tell you what it's all about. But somebody that comes into it with fresh eyes, like you, Sebastian, if you were going to come in and you'd be like, well, this is what I think, this isn't this, you probably actually have a little bit more insight than I'm like, oh, I hadn't even thought about it that way, you know? So I pay other people to write for me.
I did have another follow-up question
to
that.
Please.
Is what is some like common feedback that you've heard about your art?
Well, I'm a real strict sculptor. Like I am very much a sculptor. I'm not I do installations and things like that, but I'm an object maker. So I think people would say like, oh yeah, Nancy's an object maker. Very sensory driven. Anything that makes you want to touch it or smell it, lick it, but you're not allowed to do that. But I like to really pique your senses. And part of that comes from the materials that I use too. So like raw cotton, sometimes I think it makes me like in my mouth a little bit, but I love that, that might somehow, you know, spark somebody's kind of response, almost like a guttural or visceral response to the work. You know, I don't listen to the bad feedback. I only, because, I mean, there is an artist that just passed away. Her name is Lee Bontecou, and she was absolutely inspirational to me as an object maker. Go look at her work. You will understand. The one thing I haven't mentioned to y'all yet is that my background mainly is in welding. We haven't talked, we can talk about that in a minute. But Lee was a welder that made dimensional canvases that hung on a wall. And she did a show in the 60s in New York, and they panned her show. They criticized it, and it was terrible. And she said, well, fine, then I'm not going to show because I'm not really doing it for you. You know, I'm making the work for me. And so for years, she made art in seclusion. And eventually, you know, 30 years later, somebody was like, whatever happened to Lee Bontecou? And they found out she kept making art in her studio. And all of a sudden, she was cool again. And then she never became uncool. And she's been absolutely cool. And she said, I'm not interested in your criticism at all. It doesn't help me make my work, and it's not why I do it. So I don't really care what other people say, I think. One of the first questions I ask my freshmen when they come to my classes, I'm like, all right, here's the deal. And I teach both artists and designers because at PNCA, 50-50 of the students are illustration, graphic design, and then the rest are the fine arts majors. And in 3D design, they're all in that class mixed together. And I say, all right, what I want to know is who's your favorite artist or designer? And I'm like, we'll have 3 minutes to think about it. I just really want you to think about that. Who are you coming in? It's going to tell me a lot about what you know about art and design in this world and all this kind of stuff. And they're all thinking and they write things down and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, trick question, guys. You're your own favorite artist or designer. Because if you don't love it, what you're doing, and you're not making the best thing that you know how to make, you know, then nobody else is either. So I like to be slightly cocky in that way and just say I'm my own favorite artist. Like, so I don't really, you know, get uptight. When you get critiqued, so my best friend and I critique each other all the time too. I get her to come in here. I trust her. She doesn't make me feel bad when she tells me something I don't want to hear. You know, then all it makes me do is think about how to make something better. So I find that I go to people I trust. I'm not going to listen to people otherwise. So
there you go. I had like one more question, and it kind of goes into the welding question. So have you ever collaborated with other people to make sculptures or weldings?
Yeah, I collaborate with my husband. I met him in graduate school. He was, oh my gosh, I'm going to say this, my boyfriend's roommate. And I ended up, yeah, that's good, isn't it? He's an architect, and so he has a really good sense of space. And often I will do large-scale site-specific installation work, and then I'll collaborate with him, because once it really gets blown out beyond kind of object or figurative body scale, then I really need help. And he is amazing at this. And he and I are really good collaborators. And we do, we've done probably 10 or more projects together. It's fun to collaborate. Our brain thinks in different ways, and we bring them both to the table. So that's pretty fun. With regard to my welding, what I want to tell you all, so when I was in graduate school, I learned to weld. And so when I moved to Portland, my first teaching jobs were part-time. And I thought, well, what else can I do? I'm like, well, I know how to weld. And so I started my own welding business, and that was the most money I ever made, was doing my own welding business. So I'm a big fan of the trades. The trades are very lucrative. If you look at the PCC website, on the front of every program that they have there, two-year program, like automotive collision repair, two-year program, and the first thing that pops up on those pages is, this is what your starting pay is. It's $62,000 a year. That's pretty good money. You know, that's starting pay for a welder. That's, yeah, wow. I'll also tell y'all that I'll give you one free welding lesson just to get everybody kind of excited about it. I have a 21-year-old that was a freshman in college when COVID hit, and he was really questioning if college was right for him, and just how online classes were terrible. And so I was encouraging he and his friends, I'm like, get into the trades, man. And so I did it by, I was like, if I give you one welding lesson and you like it, then you could go onto the PCC program and keep going. And he has at least one or two buddies that have actually done that. So welding is really fun and super easy. I would love to teach you how, if anybody wants to learn to weld.
So, like, I have kind of two questions, but you could answer, like, whichever one is easier for you. So, like, when you were talking about being told to, like, take risks, what would you say is, like, the most important or the most risky, like, piece of art in your career? Like, one that you really feel like is kind of important or, like, kind of changed something about what you do?
Oh, man, you're asking it a really tough question for me. And if anybody is listening on KBOO that knows my work, they know the answer to this question, because I became infamous for a project that I did. And Erica, you're going to have to bleep this after the fact. But I got invited to make the centerpiece for a dinner party for PICA, which is the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. They had an annual fundraiser called the Dada Ball. And I don't know if y'all studied Dadaism, but it was an art movement in the 20s. And it was very anti-art. It was very much against the bourgeois. It was against the norm. It was using poetry as art versus painting. It was just undermining that which was normal or acceptable. And it was pretty degenerate, is what it was called at that time. And I thought it was ironic that they would be having a fundraiser using the theme of Dadaism, because they were inherently in opposition to each other. And somebody said to me, well, Nan, what are you going to do on the people that are, you know, putting down the money to raise to have the art thing? And I was like, yes, yes, I am. I'm going to do that. And so I made a Sunday, and it sat on the table as a centerpiece during the dinner. And people kind of were like, Nan made it, I think. Do you, but what is it? I don't really, like, it's a Sunday, is it? And it looked like a Sunday, and it had all the toppings of a Sunday. And, but I think about a third of the way through, people were like, I think that it's what we think it is. And by the time I got to the event, because artists weren't invited to the dinner, we were only allowed to go to the after party. It was already at the dumpster. So I got busted. I'm known to be a bit of a brat, and I like that. And so, yeah, that was the beginning of my brat, my full-on brat stages. I've never really done anything quite so gross. I don't apologize for it, because I think it was completely appropriate, despite the fact that it was completely inappropriate. It was all of that all in one. Nice little Sunday. So, yeah, I made that.
That's awesome. I have, like a follow-up question. So you said, like, it was, like, you think, like, you, like, kind of being sort of, what's the word? Like argumentative, I guess, kind of with your art. Like, do you think it's important for artists to be kind of, like, kind of safe like kind of make say messages like that, kind of like my brain is not working, but like kind of like
I know
like
what you mean though, like I don't think you have to be confrontational or aggressive. I think, you know, being subtle and sweet is also totally productive. I like to be a little bit more sinister than that. But also I like things that are nice and soft and joyful. I want to bring back the word sentimental. I think that's cool. Like, who doesn't want a big hug, you know? So I even make sculptures that are to be hugged and stuff like that. But I don't think you have to be, I think you were trying to get a confrontational or, you know, you don't have to do that as a way to get to a viewer. I think you can kill them with kindness too. So I think it's just the way that you choose, and that both ways or any way is totally appropriate. There is no way that you shouldn't do. How's that? You can do whatever you want because you can't be wrong, because it's art and design. You know what I mean? Because that's what we're doing. We're just working with what we've got. So if you just understand you can't be wrong, then you can try anything. You know, it might fail too. I mean, that's the other thing. Is like, it's interesting to look at this show I just had, because it's obvious to me which pieces people loved and which pieces people were like, eh. And then there are ones that I look at and I'm like, eh, that piece didn't really work out. And somebody will come up to me and tell me they love that piece. I'm like, really? Okay, great. So it's pretty subjective. And I do like being a little bit bratty, a little bit in there, a little pushing at your side, but I don't know that that's, you don't always have to use that as a tool.
Did you ever talk about
into the mic?
Oh, sorry.
Please.
Did you ever talk about? Oh wait, you might have talked about this already, but did you ever say your favorite project?
I did not, actually. I mean, I'm so fresh off of my last show that I would have to say, I'll just call it my favorite project. It was the biggest show that I've done, both physically, it was in a very large space. It was a lot of work. And I was trying to find ways to extend out the experience of an exhibition. And so I did these talks on Saturdays with other artists where we would talk about, maybe we would talk about my work, but it could go anywhere. I didn't really care where it would end up. And they were supposed to be casual. I asked the people not to practice before, or they didn't have to do research or anything. Let's just get in here and talk together. And it was so thoroughly awesome. It just, it was like my Acme art experience. It was connecting with people. The work got seen. It had lots of different iterations. The space was just perfect. Yeah, I just keep building on a previous experience so that I don't live in a space of regret. Like, that one was really good. That being said, I find that artists probably have had this experience where they, I hope you probably are hearing upstairs, there is a, they're drawing water or something. But where you do a show that's so good that people kind of always think of you with regard to that show. And I think that's true for most artists. I did a show called Nanco, and people still call me Nanco. They don't, it's Nan Company, Nanco, and I made a series of products, and it was a good show. It wasn't that great, but it really stuck in people's mind. And so Nanco is something that kind of continues to live on. My 15-year-old really always loved the idea of Nanco, and I made t-shirts, and so he has gotten me to reboot the logo of Nanco. And so I'm trying to see if I have something. I have a really big one right there. Nanco. And I make t-shirts and stuff. And so he's gotten me to kind of, I'm getting patches made and t-shirts. And so that one lives on. But I hope that I'm always building on top of something versus reflecting back.
I heard that you mentioned a hugging project, like a sentimental, I think the word you used. Have you ever thought of like sculpting with like, do you work with clay?
I don't actually. You know, clay is such a huge material, like in terms of the process part of it. And the thing I got into was welding. Like I kind of, you know, there's welding and there's clay and there's glass, and plaster is kind of material that is a means to an end of material. So it's not necessarily one, I don't know, but I put all my time into welding versus clay. I also don't like things that take too long, and it takes me too long. You got to, you know, make the clay,
yeah,
mix it, make the object, let it dry, put it in a kiln. Maybe it didn't break. Then you get it out, and then you.
Yeah.
So with welding, I go, I got a piece of steel, and I got another piece. And I put them together, and I go, done.
Yeah.
I love that. Done. There we go.
Even without working with clay, just working with materials that you've mentioned, have you ever thought of like sculpting like almost like two people like hugging to represent a sentimental piece?
I haven't, but I love that idea. I did just in my last show, I made this large conical object out of moleskin. It's a kind of fabric that's really soft, and it was built to my height and stuffed with cotton. It kind of ended up, a lot of people thought it looked like something from The Night Before Christmas, that the animated movie. But when you touch the moleskin, you can see your finger mark in it. And then when you touch it in the other direction, it erases it. So it's that kind of fabric, you know. But people would kind of go like, and I said, you can touch it. And by the end of the day, they were like hugging this object because it was just huggable. So maybe I made that object already, but I made the conical, and that the second figure is the person coming in.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, and I have a ton of respect for clay. Clay is an incredible, it comes out of the earth. I think that's amazing. Like, that is just, it's like nothing else. I have done a couple of clay things. I've made some clay work, and I've been out to the East Creek Onagama Kiln, which if you guys haven't, you should go. It's absolutely life-changing. It is a kiln, a Japanese-style kiln that's built into the side of a hill. And it takes, it's wood fire, so you have to stoke the fire constantly with wood 24/7 for 7 days. So what you have are teams of people that are staying up all night, cutting wood, chopping wood, stoking fire, and working together kind of in harmony to fire everything that's in there. It's amazing. And they invite people to come out and watch, chop wood, hang out, camp on the land. It's really incredible. So clay's cool. Yeah.
When I've heard of like welding, I'm like, oh yeah, it's that thing where you take metal and you like burn stuff against other metal. Well, I'm really curious on what artist block looks like with welding. Can you like tell, have you ever experienced that with welding?
An artist block?
Yeah.
Like a creative block?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know what I do? I don't weld because I can do all kinds of other things. And that's why a lot of people don't necessarily consider me a welder, because I don't always do it in my work. I find it is a one thing. It's, you know, metal to metal, just like you said. But I like to work with wax and cotton and animal skin and fur and flocking and glitter and all kinds of other, you know, chairs. So it's kind of a limitation. But all of a sudden, I'm like, I want that chair to be 6 feet up, so I can weld myself an armature that will hold it 6 feet up. So I find that I use welding more as an, it's like a tool that helps me build other things. It's not that I'm a metal sculptor. It's more like I build armatures to make bigger, strong things. So it's more of a means to an end. But that being said, when I was welding for money, I was doing like handrails and what light sconces and, you know, small objects that are one of a kind, very metal based. Steel in particular is what I weld. I don't do aluminum or stainless. I'm pretty a straight up steel welder. So, I don't actually, if I get in a block, I just don't do it. I'm like, yeah, no thanks, not going to do that. Plaster is another material I love working with. And I'm not, I have not been a big mold maker in my life, which plaster likes to be cast in molds. But I have just been learning about molds, and that is so fun. So plaster is one of my favorite because, again, I talked to you about how I'm very visceral. And plaster, I like to mix it with my hands. I mean, you're not supposed to eat it, but I sure could. I'm like, so good. But I've never actually eaten it. It's not good for you.
This is not an endorsement.
Yes, do not eat plaster.
Nan, you have basically ended up sort of in all of your answers kind of touching on a lot of the stuff that I was interested in. But one of the things that I like to offer the guests on the show is if you have any questions that you'd like to ask the students, we can turn the microphone around. Is there something that you want me to ask or that you want to ask them?
No, honestly, I was excited to talk to you all because I started out by telling you that my favorite students that I taught were the freshmen incoming. It's you guys. I'm looking at all of the people that I love to teach. They come in and you guys are so excited and you're so like, I mean, it's the best place to be when I was at art college is that fresh mind. It's totally willing and open and ready to try anything. I mean, that's the ultimate risk taking. Is when you are just willing to go. And that's what art school was for so many freshmen. And I love doing it. So I was hoping that you guys would give me an opportunity to be able to say all that kind of stuff. I got it in there along the way because it was important to me. But I think that if you want to go on and practice art and design, you should, and that you shouldn't be worried about it because there's no guarantee with anything else anyway. Getting your BA from a liberal arts college is great too, but that's not going to get you any other kind of job either. So learn how to write, read, make things, and then commit. I mean, I think that's a big thing, and that's a hard thing for artists. Again, they don't want to treat what they do like a business, and yet it is. And then you can make a whole life out of it. And that's a pretty cool thing to do. So that being said, I'm absolutely not disappointed that I was a teacher as well, because that was just apparently what I was supposed to do. And if not that, I would have been a nurse, which is why I'm going into death doula now to work with people. So I think it's in there somewhere, but that's what I have to say.
Yeah, I just realized that you said you were interested in talking about your death doula work, and I'm so curious about it, but we're basically out of time. Do you have anything else that you wanted to add about maybe how did you find yourself becoming a death doula?
I helped my dad pass, and he was reluctant, and he didn't want to do it, and yet he needed to. And so my siblings and I helped him pass, and it was just amazing and meaningful. And I thought, gosh, if people went into this process a little bit more willing, because it's happening to all of us for sure, that it could be even better. And so I got a little obsessed with that. And so I've been volunteering in hospice and training to be a death doula, though there's no necessary certification to do it. It really, again, it just takes your ability to be able to sit there with someone in a really hard time in their life, and it's just amazing. I am interested in finding the way that it dovetails with my practice, and I think I've done a project called The Rekindling where people gave me things of theirs and I made art out of it and gave it back to them. And I think that there might be something in that where I can almost make it like a service to people at the end of their life, that I can craft something out of something that they have. So we'll see. Yeah.
Well, I think we're out of time. The students have to move on to the next part of their day. So I just wanted to say thank you for being here and sharing all this really beautiful and interesting stories and information about
your path to being an artist. And so how does somebody get a hold of you or find your work on the internet?
Nan at nancurtis.com.
Great.
Right through my website you can get me. And I want to say thanks to you all. I was really excited to be asked by high school students to be talking to their class. I love that. I think it's probably one of the most important places where you all should be experimenting, taking risks, doing wild things. Just try new things. That's all.
Thank you so much, Nan. We've loved having you. We appreciate it. And thank you all students for coming and bringing your beautiful, insightful questions.
Yeah, thank you so much, y'all.
We're on the air on the fourth Wednesday of every month on KBOO. You can stream at kboo.fm, or you can listen live from 11 to noon on the fourth Wednesday of the month at 90.7 FM in Portland.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Nan.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.